From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. If you've dined out with friends in LA, surely you've participated in a time-honored ritual, the after-dinner debate about where to go for a nightcap. Los Angeles's bar scene is as huge and diverse as our restaurants, from historic landmarks to tiki bars to trendy bars posing as speakeasies. Legends have always imbibed here. Think of Faulkner, Dorothy Parker, Sinatra, or Hemingway.
The ideal situation is when you find atmosphere, community, and a really great drink.
Writer Andrea Richards has gathered LA's long, rich history of bars and cocktails in a compact book. It's called Los Angeles Cocktails, and it contains recipes from some of LA's most beloved and fabled bars. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
Could you do me a favor and read a quote from a man named Henton Helper that you have in the beginning of your book?
Sure. I have seen purer liquors, better sugars, finer tobacco, truer guns and pistols, larger dirks and bowie knives, and prettier courtesans here than in any other place I've ever visited. And it is my unbiased opinion that California can and does furnish the best bad things that are obtainable in America.
Andrea, you say our city is sunshine and noir. Is noir where the cocktails come in?
Definitely, noir is where the cocktails come in. It's hard to walk down Hollywood Boulevard and not want to have a drink, right? I think there's been so much noir to nightlife in Los Angeles for years and years. And I was just thinking today that it's only now starting to get a little bit sunshiny. You know, nowadays there's a lot more places where you actually sit outside during the day to drink. But, you know, for a long time, having a drink in Los Angeles was something, you know, you did in a dark corner.
How does our legendary diversity play out in the cocktail scene?
Oh my gosh. I mean, in much the same way that it is plays out in the restaurant scene where we've just got something for everyone and, you know, every ethnicity under the sun, you know, has an amazing, incredible bar or mini bars. And there's just so much diversity in terms of drinks and the ingredients that people are bringing to drinks right now. I mean, there's an amazing new bar in Hi-Fi that's serving Filipino-inspired cocktails. They're delicious. They're incredible.
What is Hi-Fi?
Sorry, historic Filipino town.
Just for those who aren't in the know.
Yeah. It's called Genever, like the drink.
So this book, it's really special. First of all, it's beautifully put together, and it really does show off all the different styles of places to drink that there are in LA. So I want to start with Bordner's in Hollywood.
Yes, yes.
You call it a bar with a background in bravado. How so?
It's definitely, I mean, talking about the noir, it's got the serious noir element there. It's the red leather banquettes, the dark atmosphere, you know, a kind of quintessential Hollywood watering hole with a long history that, you know, I haven't been there recently, and I sure hope they haven't redone a thing to it.
Oh, I'm sure they haven't. I think people would picket.
Yes, I would be one of the picketers for sure.
What's the appeal of drinking there?
I think there's just always going to be a place with history that, I mean, even if you're having a well drink from there, it's, you know, there are some nights that just call for that over any elegantly crafted cocktail, you know, in the city. So the appeal, I think, is you just really get a, it's like time travel. You know, you're entering these time warps where you can go back in time and kind of imagine the LA, you know, of Chandler, you know, or of another era. And, you know, it's a dream space, really.
Oh, I love that. A dream space. It really is. The next bar I want to talk about is so different than Bordner's, yet still in Hollywood, the bar at Musso and Frank's.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I mean, I think that's pretty much on the, you know, top iconic spot for any person who wants to have a drink in Los Angeles. I mean, you have to go to Musso's and you have to have the martini, right? And again, it's, to me, it's just a time-honored tradition that is going to, you know, link us as humans to our predecessors that, you know, my grandmother came to Los Angeles and, you know, she didn't drink, or so she never had a martini at Musso's, but she could have. And it's, you know, that kind of amazing. There's not so many places in Los Angeles that stick around, and Musso's is one, and having a drink there is like having a drink nowhere else.
So let's go to another historic bar, but at a very different part of Los Angeles, the Tam O'Shanter.
It's a great place. I mean, again, there's so many great stories about the Tam O'Shanter and, you know, its links to Walt Disney. And I think, you know, you can't go to the Tam O'Shanter and not smile, you know, and not have a good time. And it doesn't matter who you go with, you know, you can go with friends. I can take my kids there now. It's just an extraordinary place. And, you know, that hasn't changed, except for they did add a patio recently.
So that's an Atwater. Mm-hmm. And is it true that it's 90 years old?
I think that is true. Yeah, the Tam O'Shanter's been there a long time. I'd have to double check the dates to say exactly, but yeah, it's definitely been there a long time.
And what is the thing to order there?
They are known for their Moscow Mule, and apparently it's said to be the closest one to the original Moscow Mule that was made at the Cock and the Bull that was in Hollywood before. And, you know, the great thing about a couple different of the older bars in LA, like the Tiki T is another example, is that the bartenders worked at, you know, older bars and brought some of their recipes with them. So, you know, the Tiki T is apparently the closest place you can ever get to Don the Beachcomber's zombie and stuff like that. So it's a real, you know, it's a living art that you get to see and you get to taste.
So these days, there, of course, there's always new bars opening, and it seems like more groups are just spending an enormous amount of money to create nostalgia, to create a very particular scene set almost in which to house the drinks. What's your take on this?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting because when I first started the book, I had this theory that this being Los Angeles and having Hollywood, that there was a real kind of theatricality to bars here, you know, and that they were being built like stage sets, like something like, you know, Davy Wayne's or these kind of faux speakeasies that have all these really cool entryways and are very theatrical. And so I started with that premise. And then, but the other thing we have that you can't build anywhere else is historic bars that are crazy theatrical in their own way. You know, you can't get a space like Union Station. You know, you can't just build that. We have the authentic one. And, you know, I was just reading about the new bars that are opening there. And I'm so excited because, you know, instead of having to create atmosphere, we already have it. You know, there's so many great spaces that already have it. And it seems like there's a whole crop of bar owners now who get that and who are more about restoring, you know, or showcasing the incredible atmosphere that's already here. You know, I am a big fan of the 1933 group who goes in and, you know, takes something like the Formosa and instead of trying to hippify it, understands how incredible the original space is and is just about bringing that back.
So let's come to like our modern era and talk about a place that I think is really important, the Copadoro and Vincenzo Marianella.
Yes. I was so lucky that Vincenzo wrote the foreword to the book, and I was really psyched to meet him because he's such an incredible person and such a pioneering bartender. And what I loved about it is I was really kind of intimidated to speak with him, and I thought, oh, his level of craft and cocktail making is just beyond me and really incredible. And the thing that I love about him is like most bartenders and like most great chefs, like when he's off the clock, he goes to a dive bar and drinks a beer.
So, I love that.
I do too. There was a moment where I think this craft cocktail world became so rarefied and it started becoming really inaccessible. And that's the last thing that a bar is supposed to be. You know, bars are supposed to be places for people to gather, to have a good time. So I really love what he wrote in the book and I love his foreword because he talks about, you know, there's something to a bar that doesn't have anything to do with the quality of drinks there actually, you know, and that's the community. That's what you have around you.
So we've been talking about a lot of things, but we haven't been talking about the actual drinks. Could you pick just a couple of drinks and talk about why you chose to include them in the book and talk about the link to where they're made and who's making them?
Sure. There's a hilarious one called Owen Loves His Mama that's from the Highland Park Bowl. And anyone who grew up watching Goonies can understand the reference to Owen Loves His Mama. And I love this because I feel like it's just everything that that going, you know, that drinking should be. It's just a fun play. You know, I mean, there are times when all you want is an old fashioned and you just want to be classic and pure on it. And then you go to Varnish and you have, you know, a delicious one. But other times drinking should just be fun. And this drink is a lot of fun and it's delicious. And it has hibiscus. It has like a jalapeno infused tequila and it comes together and it's absolutely delicious and it's fun. And you drink this and then you want to go bowl.
So Halloween's around the corner. Did you encounter anything paranormal during your research?
I have to say, nothing specifically super paranormal, but I do, you know, I think part of the noir vibe of so many LA bars is that they all seem somewhat haunted, always. And one of the bars where I've experienced this the most, and it actually isn't in the book, and that breaks my heart every time I think about it because I love this place, is the HMS Bounty over at the Gaylord Building over on Wilshire. And it's nautical themed. It's pristine in many ways. And it's a great divey bar with history. And it's also the first place in LA where I ever saw anyone get a to-go drink, which, you know, I'm still not sure the legality on that. But like it was packed in a styrofoam glass and you could take it by the pool at the Gaylord. But it's across the street from the old Ambassador Hotel. And, you know, the Ambassador, of course, I think is a highly haunted site. And there's always a little creepy thrill up my back when I'm at the Bounty.
That's Andrea Richards. Her book is Los Angeles Cocktails, Spirits in the City of Angels. That would make a great gift book. Coming up, we visit a bar that offers one of the most unique cocktail experiences you can find in L.A., so sit back, relax, pour a glass, and stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Cocktails writer Caroline Pardia is always on the hunt for interesting watering holes around L.A., not only places with delicious drinks, but with great ambiance, too. We're talking about a bar she recently visited that offers one of the most unique cocktail experiences in the city. Where did you go?
I went to the Walker Inn in Koreatown.
So describe what it looks like from the street.
Oh, you can't even see it from the street because it's way in the back of Normandy Club on 6th and Normandy.
So it's like a speakeasy, a door past a door.
Yeah. What's funny is that their secret door is labeled secret door.
I love that. A good sense of humor is a good thing.
What secret is in quotation marks.
It's interesting to me that there would be a bar within a bar. So what is the difference between the Normandy Bar and the Walker Inn?
The Walker Inn is more cocktail forward, more experimental. They have actually a tasting menu. Back in the day when they opened about 3 years ago, they had themed menus around elaborate themes. Like they had a Pacific Coast Highway theme where there was a cocktail that arrived with its own fog, which was a strong black tea and a bit of dry ice. It was very epic. The next theme they had was a Wet Hot American Summer, was based on that movie. And they had a graham cracker infused bourbon old fashioned served with a burnt marshmallow. So they really went all out with those themes. But now, like, they have seasonal cocktail menus.
And is it tasting flights? I mean, when I think about a tasting menu of food, I find even those hard to get through. I would imagine that I would just be horizontal really quickly if I had to go through a cocktail tasting menu.
Oh, yeah. I think they keep that in mind. So they serve you five courses, but it equals out to about three cocktails.
There's a look of horror on my face.
But they space it out, and it's like an hour and a half, and they give you treats, like little things to eat, like nibble on. I mean, I was fine, but I would definitely recommend Ubering there or, you know, getting some other way to go there and leave because it's, you would be walking funny on the way out.
When you walk in the door, what's the scene like? What are you seeing?
So it's a beautiful lounge. There's a bunch of plush couches, a booth. They actually updated their seating area, so they have this huge booth that now fits more parties. There's a wall filled with, it looks like liquor lockers. I don't know if they're using it for liquor lockers yet, but that was supposed to be one of the options. And then to the left, there's that bar that with the 6 bar stools and then the bartender waiting for you.
Does it have kind of a historic old LA feel?
Yeah, the wood is dark. Like the Normandy Club, it feels more New York. And I don't know if that's because of the proprietor's touch, but their bars tend to feel like that.
Who were the patrons?
Well, when I sat at the tasting table or the bar, there's like 6 seats, 6 bar stools. And like far away from me, there was a couple. One was a YouTuber and the other was a software engineer, and he was with his friend and he found out about it on Yelp.
I just got, you know, usual old fashioned whiskey. Nothing like particularly unique. So this is pretty unique for me.
And then in the lounge, there's like dates, like, you know, couples everywhere. So, but it's smaller, it's a little bit quieter, more intimate than Normandy Club, which is just this cool, regular cocktail bar.
$70 a person, and is it a time tasting? So is everybody getting everything at the same time?
Well, so the 6 bar stools, they get the tasting. There are seatings at 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock, and then the lounge is just a regular lounge. You could walk in if they have available seats.
And is that, too, do you have to take the tasting menu, or in the lounge, can you order a la carte, as
you
it
could,
were?
Yes, you could order a la carte, and you could also order what they call a petite tasting. I think it's like 3 tasting items rather than 5 at the bar.
That would be more my style.
Yeah.
Who is the owner and the bartender?
Well, the owner is it's the proprietors, LLC. They also own Death & Company and Honeycut and Normandy Club. They're also, that partners up with 213 with Said Moses. Oh, and my bartender was the head bartender of Walker Inn. Her name is Sarah Ahn.
I did not intend to be in bartending for sure. I thought I wanted to be in the food business, in the kitchen. But when I started working here, one of the shifts, they needed a prep person. And so I volunteered. I was like, I know how to hold a knife. I can cut some citrus. And then it was in that moment I totally fell in love.
How does the tasting menu unfold?
For this tasting menu, the summer one, they started by placing a sheet with 6 circled line drawings, and you had to pick a circle and 2 colors from their crayon bucket. And which colors you pick determine the cocktail that you have at the end. So they start with that, and then you draw it in, and then they take it away from you, and then they present you with a white peach spritz. The next course was a Negori sake and pisco cocktail, followed by a butterwash vodka martini that came with a fried potato. It was like a French fried potato sort of thing.
This all sounds great to me. So far, it's all white spirits.
Mm-hmm. For some reason, the heavier spirits were at the end because it was DIY rum and coke, where you have these 3 vials of citrus, spice, and vanilla, and then you get to tailor it to your taste if you want it like a sweeter rum and coke, or if you want it like a spicier one. So in the glass was rum with ice, and then you had the soda, and then you had the vials, and you think it was just like tinctures.
What did you pick?
Oh, I didn't like too sweet because the rum was already sweet, so I went more with spicier and citrus so that it was brighter and drier.
Does the Walker Inn have a signature drink?
Actually, they focus more on the tasting menu. They have their standard classic cocktails available in the lounge, but the tasting menu changes seasonally this time. So the one that I really liked was the one at the end where they based it on the picture that I colored, and it was called Laurel Canyon, which was like a new agey yoga-inspired drink. And it had date-infused bourbon, fig leaf distillate, pamplemousse, and grapefruit zest. And the way they presented it was they smudged it with like burning sage. They're like, oh, this is to clear off the energy, you know.
And that's the yoga part.
Yes. I was like, what are they doing? And then they added, for mine, she added cinnamon and fennel to match my kapha energy, which I guess since I picked blue and brown, that represented my earth and water energy.
So it's the sky and the earth. That's so perfect. We're going to do some cinnamon to match the spice in your life, and a little bit of fennel to keep you rooted in the ground always. All right. May this complete your energy, Caroline. Cheers.
Thanks so much for taking us out to drinks. That was fun.
Thanks. We should go for real drinks.
Oh, I would love that. Okay. But not five.
Yeah.
That's cocktail writer Caroline Pardia. We've been talking about the Walker Inn in Koreatown. Simone in LA Arts District has been one of the most anticipated restaurant openings this year. Many diners have been eager to see Chef Jessica Largie back in the kitchen after turning heads at restaurants like Providence and Manresa. But to get to the dining room, you first have to pass through Duello. It's a 25-seat bar with a cocktail menu in tribute to the history of the Arts District.
It's good to move forward, but it's good not to forget your past.
It's the brainchild of Ian McPherson. Before we get into the menu, I'd love people to know a little bit about you.
Yeah, so I'm from Scotland. I've got three bars in Edinburgh, Panda & Sons, Nauticus, and Hoot the Redeemer. And even Panda & Sons this year was voted 61 by the world's top 50 best bars, which I was really delighted by. And one of my main draws to work over here was to learn and understand a new culture. Like anywhere I go, because being brought up, you know, born in Australia, lived in Thailand, Vietnam, Hong Kong, I've always loved experiencing new cultures. So that was a main draw for me.
Talk to me a bit about the name, Duello.
Joe and I came up with the name because it basically means duel, and we just sort of tied quite nicely into the, you know, the chapters we've got of the changing landscapes of the Art District. So basically the whole land has been dueling and reimagining itself since the first days of LA, so we thought it was quite a fitting.
Who's Joe?
Joe Russo is one half of the Russo brothers, and they directed the latest Avengers movie. Yeah, and it was, I was guess, either fate or luck that we met. Joe likes a good drink, and so he'd obviously researched Edinburgh, where to go, and, you know, Panda & Sons was very high up on the list, and he checked us out. And I didn't realise he'd been drinking in Panda & Sons and Hoot the Redeemer for 2 years. You know, he's just one of the nicest guys I've met and really humble. And this one day, I just got an email from him asking to meet and talk about his venture.
When you first signed up for the project, did you have any idea that the district itself was going to become the influence for the menu?
No, not at all. So obviously, I like to know where I'm going. And it was a real chance meeting with Joe. And, you know, he was like, I'd like you to come over to the Arts District in Los Angeles and see, you know, what you feel like about the bar and the restaurants and stuff. And I have never heard of the Arts District, so I started researching it just to understand some background about where I'm going. And I always do that wherever I travel. And I just, the more I researched it, the more fascinated I became with the Arts District. And in such a short space of time, it, you know, changed landscapes so many times, you know. So When I read all that and read, you know, how, like, you know, it was a catalyst, you know, for the wine boom in California, even though there's not really any existence left of a wine business in the Arts District and around LA, I realized this was how I'd want to design the menu.
Okay, so let's talk about this really incredible menu. It's broken down into four distinct eras of the Arts District. And as you said, it starts with wine, because LA used to be the wine county of the United States all along the river.
So it was just full of vineyards, you know, and a Frenchman, Jean-Louis Vigne, came over. And, you know, he wasn't necessarily a wine connoisseur, but he obviously liked to drink wine. And he saw, you know, Spanish missionaries already growing grapes there for more kind of religious purposes. But he saw a big opportunity to start making a business out of it. And before very long, literally everywhere you could see from all four corners of the Arts District was vineyards. You know, he was bringing Cabernet and Sauvignon Blanc vines over from Europe and growing them there.
And he still lives on in Vignes Street.
That's correct. Vine Street.
our lovely way of pronouncing, yeah, massacring his name, yes. So give me just a taste of something that's on the wine-influenced part of the menu.
Great. So I've got a really delicious one here, the Bota Secreta, which we use this amazing peach-fortified wine. We marry with rosé vermouth and dry vermouth. And then I also make an orange and grapefruit oleo, which is basically, it's kind of like an oil syrup. So what the sugar does is it extracts the essential oils from the zest of the citrus and then basically some bitters. And then we just use a little touch of peated whiskey just to give it a bit of depth.
Peated whiskey, for people who aren't really in the know with their whiskeys, describe what that is and how it's different from non-peated whiskey.
I would describe peated whiskey as the mezcal of the Scotch world, I guess. Yeah, it's very smoky. They use peat, sometimes heather peat, and it's got a really rich smokiness to it. But I thought the smokiness worked really well with the blend of vermouths that we've used.
And then the next era that you talk about is citrus.
Yes, so what I've understood from researching, everyone's looking for the next new thing, the next moneymaker, and wine was definitely the first one to do that in the area. But the gold rush, which I don't think anyone really realized why there's so much citrus in California, the Orange County, is because there was such a big demand to combat scurvy, because there's so many people trying to find gold in deserts, per se. And so they needed a demand to kind of cope with that. So all these vineyards were soon replaced with citrus groves. And yeah, and before you knew it, literally every year was covered in citrus groves. We kind of tie in some wines, we're kind of moving, kind of transitioning into the citrus. For example, like the Firing Blancs, we've got, you know, gin, Sauvignon Blanc, citrus oleo, pineapple and lemon juice. So kind of tying in chapter one, going into chapter two. And all the drinks have got a citrus element to them. And one of my favorites in the menu is our Juno, which is another term for a yuzu lemon. And I didn't realize it until I was hanging out with Jessica, going to the markets and looking at the seasonal produce. She was like, there's so much yuzu that's grown in California.
Most people have no idea.
I didn't know that. And I was so fascinated by that. So then we thought it'd be great to do a yuzu sake, mezcal, orange blossom, creme de peche, and then we make an absinthe sherbet, which goes on the rim of the glass.
So your next section is called the Young Turks. So who were they?
What happened was, you know, going through the wine, the citrus era, but then the kind of the demand for citrus kind of waned, and all these massive warehouses were left desolate and empty. Very soon after, didn't turn into a very nice neighborhood. It was, you know, it was pretty rough. But a lot of budding artists, locally and moving to the city, were trying to find a place, A, they could stay, but B, also showcase and exhibit their artworks. The first 12 that are noted were known as the Young Turks. So they're kind of writers, artists, painters, all types of art. They were kind of a group of friends. They kind of all kind of were the first catalysts on paper to move into the area.
So describe a drink from that section.
Yeah, so then I wanted to kind of talk about, this is the era when, you know, it started becoming known as the Arts District. You know, like, I believe Jessica and myself were artists in our own forms, you know, in you know, cuisine and drinks myself. So we kind of based on more famous artists, you know, for example, the Totos, inspired by Georgia O'Keeffe, that's her middle name. But one thing I did as well is I kind of did a collaboration in my mind with Po Kim for the Kimchi Gibson, which basically I wanted to kind of tie in my heritage as well. So I kind of wanted to have a subtle input of me being an artist, even though it's, you know, inspired by Po Kim, because I'm half Scottish, half South Korean. So we use a Scottish gin and then we use kimchi to create a kind of a mixed race kind of Gibson, should I say. So we make the kimchi in-house and then we pickle it afterwards to get the same elements as you would from the pickled onion.
It's so wonderful. Really, really interesting. And finally, we have sipped our way to the modern era that we're in now. Tell me about the Mamacita Mole.
So current times, chapter four, we're kind of looking at kind of current trends. So I think, you know, there's the balance or the boundary between what food and drink is getting thinner. I think, you know, there's a lot more cross techniques, you know, a lot more bartenders using chefing techniques. So, you know, like, we love mole, and actually I worked closely with Keiko, who's one of my proteges coming through and moving over to Duello soon, and she created this drink, and it's unbelievable because there's so much effort that's been put into it. I think that's what we like, is basically putting the prep work into the drinks. So we create the mole. We've got, like, you know, nuts, cacao nibs, chilies, dried chilies, chipotle, red wine. We make our own grenadine. We make our own beetroot juice, and we blend that all together, sieve it out, and then we also have our lime syrup and Blanco tequila. Because I think, obviously, in Mexican cuisine, it'd be rude not to use a tequila with this drink. And this is actually Joe Russo's favorite drink on the menu.
Well, it's really been great to meet you. Welcome to the city.
Thank you, Evan. It's been great to meet you too.
That's Ian McPherson. He created the cocktail program at Duello at Simone and was kind enough to stop by the studio before heading back to Scotland. After the break, a look at bartenders who are becoming catalysts for social change. My conversation with Aaron Polsky when Good Food continues. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. The hospitality industry is a natural landing spot for many of California's 10 million foreign-born workers. Immigrants who speak little English can often find work behind the scenes where language isn't a barrier to entry. Jobs like dishwashers and barbacks. But after a certain point, advancement can be difficult. It's a problem that troubled Aaron Polsky, bar manager at Harvard and Stone.
We need to be looking after the people that work for us.
Here's where Polsky stepped in with a solution that we learned about through an article in the LA Times. So you're a transplant here from New York.
Yeah.
And you worked at Milk and Honey there and 11 Madison Park and Absinthe Bar White Star.
Yep.
Pretty high-end bar programs.
Yeah, I'd say so.
How long were you in Los Angeles before these issues facing upward mobility with your staff started to sort of bug you?
Well, I actually noticed it in New York. I noticed how a few of the bars I worked at, most of the bars I worked at, had barbacks that had been on staff for the entirety of the bar's existence. And some of them made it to bartender, but some of them had been barbacks the whole time. And that's when I started observing it, and then it occurred to me over time that this is a problem that is a result of a language barrier and the training that can't happen.
And we should say that what makes it more unusual is in most restaurant settings, dishwashers move up. They become prep people, and then the good ones become line people. It's a business in which if you're good, we want you.
Right. That is, of course, made easier by the fact, you know, there's a term kitchen Spanish that I dislike, but
people are able to communicate, and they don't need to communicate with the customer directly.
Right, and that's what makes it easy. You do see bussers, some bussers making it up to captain, you know, in a fine dining restaurant or server, but the ascent is longer.
Did you see one guy in particular in LA that you were like, okay, I want to experiment, I want to figure out a way to help this man move?
Freddie Garcia, who is in that LA Times article that you mentioned with me, he is incredibly talented and incredibly observant and apt. You know, I pushed him into bartending. He was like, no, you know, my English isn't good enough. And I'm like, yeah, it is. It's fine. You're good. You'll be great. And he loves it now. But it needed that push because I think there's also a sort of lack of confidence in one's language abilities in a country that's not their native one.
So without a working knowledge of Spanish yourself, did you feel that you were properly equipped to train them?
No. I led a few sessions of training for a minute when I started at Harvard, and then I tried to sit down with Freddie to take the materials that I had in English and see if he could translate it. And he enlisted the help of his girlfriend. We basically realized that it was just too laborious.
You needed a real curriculum in Spanish.
Yeah, and we needed, you know, a translator.
Yes. Who did you reach out to?
I reached out to my friend Kevin, who is at Pernod Ricard. And Pernod Ricard is a giant liquor company that does a lot of community outreach, and they own Jameson, Absolute Beefeater, all these brands that people are familiar with. But they also fund this program called Bar Smarts. Bar Smarts is this great online resource that's essentially a standardized curriculum that is accessible to anyone. It's $29. It's very affordable. And they also have live components for the more advanced levels. But I approached Kevin because I knew that they had the resources and they already had the materials. You know, I wasn't piecing together what I thought was the best. I just wanted it out there. That was more important. So he, you know, came back to me very quickly and he was like, it's funded, like we're waiting for final steps, but it's likely going ahead. And I was just really excited about that.
So Harvard and Stone has an R&D bar that's manned by both international bartenders as well as your staff. Could you describe what goes on in the lab, the kind of mentorship that happens?
Every Monday we have a guest bartender and they're left to showcase whatever they want to do. So it's either, as you said, people internationally or, you know, rising talent or friends in LA. The other days of the week, the staff can do anything they want. So I like to go in there and see what they're working on and taste through it and talk through some things. And, you know, I suggest that they go to the farmer's market or this is in season or let's use these ingredients. You know, if I see a staff member over time making sort of like the same pattern of drinks, I'm like, next week I want you to make a stirred cocktail or use a bitter or something like that. And those drinks make the menu eventually. So we have our front bar menu that's set, and then, you know, we call from the R&D shift.
You obviously have a very strong sense of mentorship and stewardship. Where did it come from? Did you have a mentor?
I find it more as a social responsibility to the industry than like this sort of innate need for mentorship. I just see all of us, like the bar world, flying around the world, doing guest shifts everywhere and focusing on this stardom, which is great and leads to more full career paths that were not there previously. But at the same time, we need to be looking after the people that work for us and support us. And that's why it's like, cool, guys, we're flying all over the world talking about sustainability or paying the producers of a spirit that we use. What about our own guys? Like, what about our own barbacks? I say guys, you know, accidentally, but it does happen to be mostly males. But our barbacks and bussers who are making sure that we succeed and they're holding down the fort with these systems that we may have implemented, but they're really, you know, maintaining. We need to not relegate them to this position.
Does everybody at Harvard know that you're doing this and you want to bring people up through the ranks? Or are other bar managers in town looking at their staff differently than now that they know what you've been doing?
I've been trying to advocate it because I didn't write it. You know, like, that's what I want to make clear is I did not write this manual, but I have really been trying to advocate it. By the way, it is live, so that's really exciting. Barsmarts.com to all the bar managers and barbacks and bussers in LA. There was a cocktail week here called BevCon, or a beverage conference, and I implored them to have a Spanish track that was free of charge. And we got some amazing bartenders out, and the turnout was really minimal, and it was a real unfortunate learning experience. You know, we had Julio Bermejo come from San Francisco. He invented the Tommy's Margarita. We had Jose Luis Leon from Mexico City, one of the best bartenders in the world. But we didn't have good turnout. And I think part of that was maybe I didn't advocate enough and maybe we didn't get it out well enough. But there's also the very real truth that it's dangerous to get a bunch of undocumented immigrants into one room, you know, and to publicize it. And that was really unfortunate. And also, their barbacks might be our barbacks at night, but they're probably working in the kitchen somewhere during the day. And so they have two or three jobs, essentially have to live in the shadows. And, you know, you can't do this stuff in a public space. So I'm trying to advocate the best I can. But I think the way we need to do this is the way that we did it, which is digitally, you know, and then do the rest of the learning in your bar.
Did Freddie come up with a cocktail that kind of blew you away?
He does pretty frequently. We have on our menu currently a cocktail that he made that's one of our biggest sellers. And it's aged cachaça, white rum, watermelon, lemon, and mint. And we actually serve it in a pretty cool way. We take watermelon, cube it into, you know, if you've been to a bar like The Varnish or, you know, Walker Inn, they have ice that's the size of the glass, pretty much, one big rock. So we take the watermelon, compress it in the sous vide, and then fuse it with a little bit of rum and Aperol and freeze it. So we use that as the ice cube. So as it melts, it releases that flavor, but it's also visually appealing from the get-go. Have a giant chunk of watermelon in your drink.
That sounds pretty great. That's Harvard and Stone bar manager Aaron Polsky. We've been talking about his efforts to create bartending manuals in Spanish for immigrant workers. In male-dominated fields, women are often asked a seemingly well-intentioned question. What is it like being a woman in your industry? But writer and bartender Hope Ewing says the question is actually a bit insidious. It puts the onus on women to explain a lack of representation rather than on industry leaders.
I was talking to Aisha Sharp, who is a OG New York City bartender. You know, she said she gets asked that all the time, and her retort is always like, I don't know, what is it like to be a male journalist? because it's always like the male journalists that are asking that.
Hope wants to draw attention to women in the alcohol business who are forging new ground, paving the way for a more inclusive and sustainable world of drinks. She's written a book on the subject called Movers and Shakers. I was somewhat aghast to learn that up until 1971, women were not allowed to work as bartenders in the state of California, as in it was actually illegal. How was that even possible?
Well, I should clarify, it was technically illegal. Whether or not, you know, women were probably working at bars here and there throughout. But yes, the statute was in place that women were prohibited from working in bars, specifically in California, until 1971. And that was a fallout actually since the end of Prohibition.
Because there are plenty of cocktail waitresses hauling around those drinks.
Right, exactly. And I think that is the sort of traditional tavern experience that a lot of us grew up with, was you walk into a place and all the bartenders are men and all the waitresses are women, and there's a totally different dynamic, both between the staff and between the staff and the customers. But yeah, it's true. In many states, it was illegal for women to work behind bars, and it was a state-by-state thing, because after Prohibition ended, it was sort of left up to the states to decide how they were going to negotiate how alcohol was being served and sold. Yeah, so sometimes it was, woman who only the tavern owner could work behind the bar. So if a woman owned the majority of a tavern, she could work. Or if it was the daughters or wife of the owners. But there was this sort of strict divide that said this position of power, as it were, I think in a lot of cases. And also, you know, thinking about bars as a place of community gathering.
Where males would come and sit at the bar and unburden themselves?
Yes. Well, and interestingly enough, when I was doing some research into these blue laws, there were some states where it was even illegal for women to enter a bar through the front door. A lot of the stigma, I think, is a holdover from westward expansion and sort of Wild West days when whiskey and prostitution went hand in hand in public life.
Do you think that there still is a stigma of women being behind a bar?
Somewhat. You know, when I interviewed Carrie Hoff from Big Bar, and you're right here in Los Angeles, she has sort of mentioned that there was sort of an older holdover of women being hired to be behind the bar for their looks, you know, to draw in a certain type of clientele. And, you know, her saying, like, you know, I got into craft cocktailing and I became very good at this, for part of the reason was, like, I don't play that card. I don't have that look. And I think a lot of my colleagues, a lot of women in the industry have the same experience, is that that is sort of the stereotype. Is the sort of quote-unquote chick bartender with, who's hired for the benefit of the male clientele. Whether that bears out in reality, that hasn't been something that I have a lot of experience with. It hasn't been my experience, but it also might be a result of the world in which I live, the sort of limited craft cocktail world.
You're a former bartender. How did you find your way behind the bar, and what in your experience prompted you to want to tell the stories of women in the business?
So, you know, I, like most people, I think, I worked in hospitality in my teens and early 20s, like through school and whatnot. And then I was actually a fundraiser. I worked for New York City arts organizations for just under a decade. After that, I made a career change. I went back to school to study creative writing. I actually got my MFA in fiction from Columbia University in New York when I was living there. After going through that whole process and becoming a bit disenchanted in the process, as I feel like a lot of MFA students are, I actually started bartending in graduate school because the schedule was flexible. And this is a story that I tell over and over again through the interviews, because people say, you know, I started in school when I was studying architecture or business or finance. Or in the case of Misty Kalkofen from Boston, she was actually in Harvard Divinity School. You know, just discovering that you like your side job better than you like your degree, your field of study.
That's what happened to me.
Yeah.
I catered my way through college and once I got my degree, I couldn't let it go.
Right. I think that service industry is addictive and it's so much fun. And, you know, you just get to be around food and drink all the time. You know, who'd want to give that up?
What made you come to the moment where you realized that you had a story to tell about women behind
right.
the bar?
So throughout this process, after getting into the scene, and I would go out drinking around town, and I think there are a lot of amazing women in the Los Angeles bar scene in particular, but also on the national scale, and a lot of women doing very interesting things, distilling and brewing and making wine, etc. But so the idea to write about it actually came from a conversation I had with my editor at Unnamed Press now. We had mutual friends, and we were talking about there was sort of this dearth of positive representation of women in the alcohol business. And I think a lot of that question kept coming back around whenever you'd see someone interviewed, oh, what's it like to be a woman in this male-dominated industry? There's still a male-dominated industry, like most industries, I think, still are. But the question just became more and more ridiculous.
So let's talk about craft brewing, which until recently was seen, and how it started, I guess, was that it was a DIY hobby. Mm-hmm. What female brewmasters are headlining that market, and what do you think is unique to their product?
I mean, locally, actually, one of the inspirations for the book in general were the Three Weavers Brewery here in Inglewood. I talked to Laura Ulrich from Stone Brewing in San Diego, who is part of their small batch brewing series. And so there, she's sort of on the cusp of innovation for all of their sort of new releases.
Okay, so let's talk about distilling, because spirits has really just blown up and continues to do so. And we see small batch spirits coming online constantly. So who are some of the players that we may not have heard of?
Well, first of all, you can't talk about women in the spirits industry without talking about Joy Spence and Rachel Berry, who are master blenders of Appleton Rum. I mean, Rachel Berry has worked for a number of Scotch distilleries, but Joy Spence was the first master blender of any spirit of a major spirits company in the world. And she started in 1997. And then Rachel Berry came on. She was the one who sort of took Ardbeg Scotch, among others, from being a kind of obscure brand to a powerhouse that it is and sort of a contender in the Isla field, whereas probably 5-10 years ago, it was just Laphroaig and very little else. But one of my favorite distillers that I spoke to was a woman named Karen Hoskin, and she has a rum distillery in Colorado called Montana Rum. And not only, I thought, was her background, because she had a background in public health. She was not a chemist, not a food scientist of any kind, just a rum enthusiast who decided that this was what she was going to do one day. And so she and her husband, you know, figured it out, got the licensing down, and opened a distillery, you know, in Colorado, and were making what they call mountain rum, which was inspired by the sort of rum that they make in the Guatemalan highlands. But the most fascinating thing that I think that Karen is doing is that they're striving to be a completely green company. And I think that taking that responsibility as a producer of any product, that's so key. If you're going to start a business, having it in mind from the get-go that you're going to reduce your packaging, you know, making everything recyclable.
Do you think that as more women enter the world of creating alcohol products, that the way liquor is marketed to women will change?
It's already begun. I mean, there's still no shortage of alcohol products that are pink and have, you know, are
skinny.
They're skinny. Yes, they're always, it's a lot about calorie counts and et cetera. But, you know, I was talking to Gina Correll Aglietti from Yola Mezcal, which is a mezcal brand available now. I think they're available in New York and California. But that was one of her main gripes, was saying, like, I'm an adult. I'm interested in design. I want things to look good. I want them to be sophisticated and to appeal to me. And she just wasn't finding that. There have been some hitches, too. I think, you know, there's the stereotype of, like, the whiskey girl, right? And I think that some larger whiskey companies have picked up on that and kind of exploited it, you know, but it's still this very, like,
the rebellious chick.
Yeah, the chick with the seductive voice kind of saying, like, no, I'm a whiskey girl. And that's, it still is not, it's not hitting the mark. You know, here, you should drink this because it's delicious. Like, that's, that's the marketing that I'm looking for.
That's writer and veteran bartender Hope Ewing. She takes a look at the women behind the stick in her book, Movers and Shakers. After the break, we're talking to vermouth maker Gilles Lapalou about the fortified wine. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Vermouth has long been associated with a certain culture. Think the Mad Men era of the three martini lunch. However, there's more to the wine than you think. And yes, it's a wine.
In our instance here in Australia, we're using, for the dry vermouth, we're using Viognier with a bit of Sémillon. Medium dry, we're using Syrah or Shiraz. And then for the sweet, we're using Cabernet Sauvignon.
That's Gilles Lapalou, a maker of vermouth in Australia. Gilles and his kind are helping a new generation of drinkers discover the pleasures of vermouth, that it can be a key component to some of the best cocktails at the bar or simply enjoyed neat. It's often mistaken as a spirit, but it's actually an aromatized wine, correct?
Exactly, yeah. So it's I think the confusion starts pretty much with the fact that it's used in many, many cocktails. So always mixed with other spirits. So a lot of people will put vermouth in the same bag. The technicality of production means it's a wine. And then in Australia, we don't have any regulation on vermouth, but the main ingredient in vermouth is wine, fermented grape juice.
So could you explain what aromatized means?
Sure. When we start with the wine, it's grape that are fermented, transformation of sugar into alcohol, and then there's a process called fortification, and we add spirit to the fermenting juice. And when you do this, people are very familiar with a very famous fortified wine, which is port. When you do this, you will stop the fermentation, so retain some of the sugar. So when you make a port, you have a fortified wine, which is alcoholic and with some sugar from the fermentation. When you make an aromatized wine, you have an extra step to this by adding botanicals on top of the spirit. That's a very simple way of making the wine. The most of aromatized wine or vermouth at the moment are made by starting with finished wine, which is completely dry, no sugar, and then you add the spirit, you add the botanicals, and then you add the sugar as well, so on, with different forms. It could be sugar from cane, from beetroot, and there's caramel as well. There's all these different types of sugar you can add. Then you got the vermouth. Every maker has its own way of retaining or adding the sugar.
So it's kind of fascinating. You know, I'm imagining like this giant vat of fortified wine and then the addition of the plant material. It's almost like a tisane. It's almost like you're making an infusion.
Well, that's exactly we use the term maceration. So that's what people do. They will macerate the plants for a certain length of time into the spirit or the wine. I'll always compare with the perfume industry in a way, because what we do here, we have a natural plant element, aromatics that we want to catch. We use different ways, and the spirit is the main way here. And we then, in our case, individually extract all the aromatics, but you could easily put all the botanicals in one bag and then put it in a spirit, for example, just like you make a tisane, as you said.
So we're talking about, when we say plant material, we're talking about roots, bark, flowers, fruit, leaves, and even seeds.
Yes.
So are you looking for, when I think of vermouth, and I tend not to go for sweet vermouths, I think of almost a sherry-like kind of roundness and nuttiness with bitterness as well. Could you describe the profile of vermouth that you are trying to create as an example?
Sure. So I really like your analogy with sherry, because that's very much my starting point here. I'm a big fan of sherry, and the first vermouth I started to make was really influenced by a dry Amontillado style. And as you rightly pointed as well, vermouth always has this definite marker, which is bitter. So what we're looking when we started to create that first vermouth is to have all that ethereal smell that you have in an Amontillado, which is given by time, by all the process. With vermouth, there's a little difference. The time of maturation is not necessarily as long as in sherry, but you then have access to all the plants that give you the complexity, and that's how we bring all the mysterious smell that you can and have in the vermouth, and then the interaction in between all the plants. One of the main ones, obviously, is wormwood, because that's where the name comes from for the drink, vermouth, and the wormwood is very aromatic and is very bitter as well. So that's really, it's always your starting point, where it's herbal, it's got this all minty, resinous aromatics, and that slight bitterness as well at the back. Then you want to balance that bitterness with the role of the sugar and the role of the base wine as well, which is for us very important, is to have the highest quality base wine, which plays a big role into balancing the bitterness, the sweetness, but also the mouthfeel. Very, very important in the whole experience. And all the other elements here, like almost music notes, or like in the perfume industry, you talk about the basil note or the high notes, and they bring the colors to the drink. So it's the spice, you can have a bit more bitterness, you can have a bit more fruit with the orange zest, for example.
So let's talk about how we drink it today. Now that we know that vermouth is a wine, how do we go about pairing it with food?
There's a chapter in the book that we wrote about this, and that's very much my forte here, because I think vermouth is on its own is already so complex to discover all the different elements of the plants. And when you serve it chilled, you first don't perceive so much the sweetness and the bitterness. But as it warms up, it changes a little bit in the glass as well. On its own, it's a very complex drink. But a dry vermouth on its own with some tapas-style salty food is really, really the best way to start. It's a real aperitif. And then as you move towards the meal, you can have mussels and sashimi of fish and things like this. It works really, really well with a dry vermouth.
What's your favorite cocktail currently that you're drinking with your own vermouth?
Negroni.
That's the right answer. That is the right answer. That's wine and vermouth maker Gilles Lapalou. Along with his partner, Sean Byrne, he co-founded the Australian vermouth brand Maiden Eye and co-wrote The Book of Vermouth. Thanks for listening to our cocktail show this week. If you missed any of it, you can always listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, please tell a friend and leave us a great review if you love the show. Many thanks to the Good Food team. They are Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.